From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we discuss Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's trip to Kenosha. Then we learn about a coronavirus vaccine trial, part of which will take place at the UW Health University Hospital in Madison.
Yes, it's been an accelerated time frame, but I don't think that that's necessarily a cause for concern. I think that's more of a testament to the quality of people that have been able to bring it to this point.
We look at some of the great events happening in Milwaukee this month, including the Menominee Valley Week.
If you were to talk about doing a Valley Week 10, 20 years ago, people would say, why are you inviting people down to the Menominee Valley? We'd rather forget about that place. So the Menominee Valley has just seen this remarkable renaissance over the last 10, 15 years.
Plus, we learn about how to protest safely during the pandemic. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Kenosha had yet another high-profile visit yesterday from Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. The trip came on the heels of a visit by President Donald Trump on Tuesday, and about a week and a half after Jacob Blake, a black man, was shot by a white police officer, which led to unrest in the city. After that unrest, a white 17-year-old was arrested and charged with two counts of homicide for shooting and killing two people, Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber. Rittenhouse also injured a third protester in the shooting. WUWM's Mayan Silver is here to tell us about Biden's visit. Mayan, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks, Joy.
So tell us a bit about Joe Biden's Wisconsin visit. Where did he go? Who did he meet?
So this was Biden's first trip to Wisconsin this campaign cycle. Biden flew into Milwaukee to Mitchell International Airport. There he met with the Blake family for about an hour. That included Blake's father, Jacob Blake Sr., and his siblings, and one of his attorneys. Blake's mother, Julia Jackson, and another attorney, Ben Crump, joined by phone. The Associated Press also reported that Biden spoke with Blake, Jacob Blake, on the phone for 15 minutes during the visit. Biden said that Blake, quote, talked about how nothing was going to defeat him, about how whether he walked again or not, he was not going to give up. Blake remains hospitalized after being shot seven times in the back by police as they tried to arrest him. He's paralyzed from the waist down, his family reports. Biden followed his private meeting in Milwaukee with a public discussion with community representatives at Grace Lutheran Church in Kenosha. There were business leaders, civic leaders, and law enforcement officials. And then Biden and his wife, Jill, also had a conversation about school reopening with local parents and educators in Wauwatosa.
Well, and it's interesting that, of course, Biden met with Jacob Blake's family, in part because Donald Trump, who visited earlier this week, chose not to meet with his family, in part because of the fact that his lawyers would be there. And I think that gets to this question, really. What was Biden's main message during this public discussion?
So Biden focused on issues of race and racism. He said that racism and white supremacy motivated him to run for office again, specifically Trump's reaction to violence at a white supremacy rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, 3 years ago. That's when a white supremacist drove a car through counter-protesters and killed activist Heather Heyer. Here's Joe Biden talking about his response to that and to Trump's response.
And the President of the United States was asked, what do you think? And he said, quote, something no president's ever said. He said, there are very fine people on both sides. No president has ever said anything like that. The generic point I'm making is, not all his fault, but it legitimizes. It legitimizes the dark side of human nature. And what it did, though, it also exposed what had not been paid enough attention to, the underlying racism that is institutionalized in the United States.
Biden also talked about issues that disproportionately affect black and brown people, like poverty. He supports raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. He talked about prison reform and changing policies that impede the formerly incarcerated.
So, for example, anybody serves their time in prison, they get out, they should be entitled to every single program that exists under the federal government. Why don't we want them getting a Pell Grant and going to school? Why don't we want them getting a job and being able to get public housing subsidies? Why don't we want them qualifying for what used to be called food stamps?
So that was at the community meeting in Kenosha, but Biden also was in Wauwatosa. What happened there?
So there, Jill and Joe Biden listened at the small backyard event to three education professionals as they talked about the challenges of this school year. They talked about technology hurdles of going virtual. They talked about mental health struggles of students and teachers and low-income students in danger of falling through the cracks. Jill Biden is an educator herself, and she asked most of the questions. Joe Biden laid blame for the mess of the start of the school year on Trump's mismanagement of the pandemic.
Hmm. Well, and I think that gets to this next question. How was Biden's trip different than Trump's in both form and substance?
So first of all, Biden, like you mentioned earlier, he addressed structural racism. That's something that President Trump downplayed when he was in Kenosha 2 days ago. That's, you know, Trump was asked about structural racism, and instead of admitting it or talking about it or talking about solutions, he circled back to his theme that people want law and order. So Trump significantly focused his message on supporting the police and also on recovering from property damage. He did not address racism. And so that was one main difference. Biden also talked to Jacob Blake and met with Jacob Blake's family. And Trump didn't do that during his Kenosha visit. And Trump and other Republican leadership has said that Trump refused to meet because the family wanted lawyers involved. So notably, the family had their lawyers present with the Biden meeting today as well.
Yeah. So what was the reaction to Biden's visit from Wisconsin politicians?
There was a clear partisan divide on how Biden's visit was received. Republicans had a number of complaints. First, Republicans like Andrew Hitt, chairman of the state GOP, called out Governor Evers, who had publicly asked President Trump not to come to Wisconsin because he said it would fan flames of division. Hitt said Evers was silent on Biden's visit, notably. And Hitt said that's hypocritical and that people in Wisconsin don't want that type of hypocrisy. Republicans also pointed out that this is Biden's first visit to Wisconsin during the election. So they noted that he was supposed to come here for the DNC 2 weeks ago, but he cited the COVID-19 pandemic as the reason he wasn't coming, but that nothing has changed with the pandemic. So there was some callouts of hypocrisy there. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, on the other hand, Democrat, said that Biden is no stranger to tragedy and loss, and that Biden was there to unify and start a process of healing and to create a more fair and equitable nation.
So Democrats seem to be happy that he came, at least Senator Baldwin.
Yes, and other Democrats, yeah, too.
So I know there were some demonstrations and events scheduled as counterpoints to Trump's visit. Did we see anything like that for Biden's visit?
Kenosha was pretty calm ahead of Biden's visit and pretty much stayed that way. By midday, a small group of Biden supporters, some Black Lives Matter activists, and a Trump supporter had gathered at City Center Park that had been a focal point of demonstrations for days. When the president visited Kenosha on Tuesday, there were a few hundred pro and anti-Trump protesters convened at the spot. But then today, flashing forward to Biden's visit, he was at Grace Lutheran Church. There was a swarm of several dozen people outside lining the streets waiting for Biden. It was a mostly Biden-friendly crowd, or at least it wasn't hostile. And then there were about a dozen Trump supporters down the street with flags and signs. But our reporter Latoya Dennis was able to talk to Jamarcus Blaze. He was out in the streets of Kenosha, and he said he's tired of seeing Black people killed unlawfully, and he had a message for people about the movement.
I came out here to support Black Lives Matter and support Jacob Blake's family. It's not about Joe Biden or Ms. Harris. Okay, y'all doing y'all thing, but y'all using this protest as a political movement, right? So if I can get a message inside there, Biden, you told the people you was gonna come here and march with them, right? then get out of this church and come outside. That's all I got to say.
Around 5:30 p.m. in Wauwatosa, Press Pool reporters say that a crowd of about 200 gathered, and they were actually chanting their support for Joe Biden.
All right. Well, again, Mayan, we'll see how this plays out during the election and what sort of change there will be on the issue of police brutality and structural racism. Mayan Silver is a WUWM News reporter who has been covering the events happening in Kenosha. Mayan, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks, Joy.
Coming up next, we'll learn about a coronavirus vaccine trial taking place at the UW Health University Hospital in Madison. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Since COVID-19 was discovered and began spiraling into a full-blown pandemic, scientists around the world have been trying to develop a vaccine. As part of this global effort, the company AstraZeneca has started a large-scale human trial of its coronavirus vaccine in the U.S., with hopes of enrolling up to 30,000 adults. Here in Wisconsin, the UW Health University Hospital in Madison is looking to enroll between 1,600 and 2,000 volunteers for this trial. William Hartman is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at UW Health and UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and he's leading the coronavirus vaccine trial in Madison. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss the trial, and he begins by explaining how they got to this point.
Phase one and phase two were performed by the Oxford Vaccine Group in England. And phase one and two generally look at the safety profile of a vaccine and also to make sure that the vaccine produces its intended consequence. And so by that, does it induce the antibodies that you want it to induce to help keep a person safe? And in this case, in terms of the safety profile, people did develop a fever for a day and some muscle pain, but nothing that they considered serious and nothing that couldn't be treated effectively with Tylenol. In terms of the intended consequence, they actually saw after one dose, about 85% of their recipients or of their subjects were able to induce a pretty decent amount of the neutralizing antibodies to the spike protein of the coronavirus, but also they're able to induce a T cell response in these individuals. And these T cells are blood cells in the body that will attack and kill the virus. And so the single vector that they use as their vaccine was able to have a very good response, both antibody-wise and T-cell-wise. But then they decided to go one step further and do a second injection. And they saw a much more robust effect after they gave that second injection. And 100% of the people that were studied had both the T-cell response and a pretty robust level of neutralizing antibodies that were generated.
So for phase three, is there a significant difference in what's in the vaccine used in this trial? And what results do you hope to see? I understand the vaccine tested uses a weakened virus that causes common cold in chimpanzees. Is that correct?
That's correct. And it's been genetically manipulated so that it doesn't divide in humans. And so while it does cause the common cold in a chimpanzee, it shouldn't cause any deleterious effects in humans. It's been used before for vaccines and has been used very safely. In terms of a phase three trial, so what we do now is we go from 1,000 or so patients that are examined in phase two and expand that to a huge population. In this case, it'll be 30,000 people worldwide, mostly in the U.S., but worldwide. And we're trying to determine the efficacy of the vaccine. So we'll continue to monitor the safety. We'll continue to make sure that that intended consequence of generating the antibodies and the T cells is happening. But now we want to see, can we actually reduce the number of COVID-19 infected people within the population? And so using a big population like this, we should get enough statistical significance that we can say that if we see a decrease in COVID-19 infections, the reason that we see that is because of the vaccine.
So I want to get into some of these words and immune responses that you mentioned. So you mentioned the spike protein and that the smaller preliminary studies triggered the two immune responses of antibodies and T cells. And I'm hoping, can you explain those a little more and just break down what those do in this trial here?
Sure. So the vaccine itself is kind of a manipulated virus that does cause the common cold in chimpanzees, but inserted into that is a gene for the spike protein on the coronavirus. Everyone's seen a picture of the ball with the funny sticks sticking out of it of the coronavirus. Those sticks are what we refer to as the spikes. And so the virus needs those spikes to attach to the cells and to get into the cells and cause the infection in people. So with the vaccine, force the cells to make just that protein, so just that spike, so that the body sees this, they generate antibodies to that, and hopefully have a lasting immunity from that. The T cell response, the T cells, they just like to attack anything that seems foreign. And so these spike proteins seem foreign. And so it's training these T cells that if you see this, if a person gets COVID-19 infection, if you see a virus that looks like this, you attack it and kill it. And so it's really just kind of priming a person's body to be ready to take on the virus in case they get infected.
Now, there has been talk about when people have had the coronavirus that they've built up antibodies, but it's not quite clear how long they last, if it would defend someone against a slightly different strain of COVID-19. Is antibodies any factors into this vaccine trial or its development?
So I think that is an important point. And something that we're really going to study hard in this is we don't know how long the antibody lasts in a person. We're hearing cases now of people becoming reinfected with coronavirus. And so we'd like to have the body be able to be primed and ready to attack the virus, but have that be sort of a lasting immunity. In all likelihood, this might be something that needs a yearly booster, something like the flu shot. We just don't know. So the length of this study is actually 2 years. So patients or subjects enroll in this for 2 years and we follow them and we'll measure their antibody levels at different time points in that 2 year period, just so that we can figure out how long this immunity will last in a person.
So how does this trial fit into the scope of, you know, over 200 candidates of trials being developed for COVID-19 all over the world? There are 4 clinical trials here in the U.S. So how does this one that you're involved in at UW fit into agencies and people all over the world trying to develop this?
Sure. So the Oxford Vaccine Group that developed this is a very experienced group. They've actually developed a vaccine to the MERS virus, which is also a coronavirus, which put them in a very good position to figure out exactly what they needed to go after in terms of developing this vaccine. And so this vaccine is one of the more promising candidates, which is why it has been able to move through the phases, phase one and phase two, kind of with relative ease. There weren't any corners that were cut. The science is very sound, but they knew what they were looking for, and they were able to establish that and bring it to phase three. Of the 3 or 4 candidates that are in phase three now in the United States, these are the ones that are probably going to be your primary vaccines in terms of the main candidates that will be evaluated by the FDA for approval. And so this fits into that category of being one of the top candidates. I would suspect that at least two of these candidates will ultimately become approved, if not all three or four. But at least two of them, I think, show a definite pattern that would indicate that they are safe and effective and will be good candidates for the general population.
So this accelerated time frame doesn't concern you, because usually vaccine developments can take 10 to 15 years, but obviously it's so much effort and focus is being put into producing a vaccine for COVID-19. It's all hands on deck all over the world. So what would you like the general public to keep in mind when a vaccine is something people want as soon as possible? But as you said, corners are not being cut.
Right. And I do think that that your point is excellent, that yes, this has come to phase three faster than most other vaccines in history. But we have made sure that the very best and brightest people are working on these around the world, that we're learning lessons from vaccines that have been developed before. That accelerates the process. And just about every government in the world and most of the major pharmaceutical companies have devoted a tremendous amount of resources to developing this vaccine. So in terms of the money, the people power, and just the focus of the world, if you will, the process has been accelerated, but nothing has ever been tried like this before. Nothing has been so singularly focused that it could go on this time frame. And so yes, it's been an accelerated time frame, but I don't think that that's necessarily a cause for concern. I think that's more of a testament to the quality of people that have been able to bring it to this point.
So what requirements must volunteers meet in order to participate in the trial, and how many people are you looking for?
So here at University of Wisconsin, we're looking to enroll between 1,600 and 2,000 people. Our enrollment currently is for folks who are 18 years old to 55 years old. We're hoping that the FDA will lift the hold on the over 55 very soon, so that we can bring in an elderly population as well, so that we can figure out if this is a safe vaccine for the folks that are truly affected very badly by this virus. That being the elderly people. The other thing is we really want to make a drive to bring in as many of minority populations as possible. This is a virus that attacks everybody. It disproportionately affects people of color. And unfortunately, the original studies on this particular vaccine were done in a predominantly Caucasian population. And so we really have to make sure that this is an effective and a safe vaccine in our Black and brown populations, so that it's a vaccine that I would be comfortable giving to my family, but comfortable giving it to everybody else's family as well.
What are usually the obstacles that impact clinical trials in getting a diverse pool of volunteers?
Well, one of the big things is we have to overcome a trust issue when it comes to clinical trials and minority populations. With good reason, there's been a distrust that's developed over time. But hopefully, by reaching out, by trying to be as inclusionary as we can bring in minority populations to clinical trials so that we can better study the effects of this vaccine, other medicines, other treatments in the entire population. It will lead to more meaningful results and something that would be very, very powerful. Just traditionally, Caucasian people are more willing to volunteer for clinical trials. We don't really know why that is. And certainly Caucasian people will make up a big part of this trial as well. But we're truly making an effort to reach out to the Black and Brown communities so that we can be as inclusionary as possible.
So you mentioned this trial is over the course of a couple of years. So what are the logistics if someone is accepted into this program? You know, how are they going to go about this and be monitored over this period of time?
So they will have a weekly check-in on a mobile device app that will alert us to, are they developing any symptoms? Is there something here that we have to follow up on? And so, and then about seven times over the next 2 years, we will have either a virtual visit or an in-person visit where we will be able to assess the person through our own eyes, as well as when they come for their in-person visits, we'll be able to do blood draws and make sure that all of the parameters are within normal limits, and then also check the levels of their antibodies.
So what does it mean to you to be involved in this incredibly important worldwide effort in developing a successful vaccine for COVID-19?
Well, as a father of five kids who are waiting to get back to school, and a person who hasn't seen his own parents in about 8 months now, it would be amazing to finally get back towards normal or something that resembles normal for my family, for all families. To be part of a trial like this is truly historical. Pandemics like this are fortunately relatively uncommon. And to be at the forefront with my colleagues here at University of Wisconsin, it's a tremendous honor to try to give back really to the world a chance to get normal again.
Well, William Hartman, thank you for joining me to explain a little more about this phase of the trial. And I wish you, you know, the best of luck, great results, and continued health for yourself and your family.
Thank you very much. You stay safe, too.
William Hartman is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at UW Health and UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and he is leading the coronavirus vaccine trial in Madison. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. We'll take a break, then hear about some of the events happening here in Milwaukee this month. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every month, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service joins us to talk about some of the community events happening in Milwaukee. Since the coronavirus pandemic began, the list has included a wide array of things, from virtual exhibits to Zoom events, and now some socially distanced in-person gatherings. Carr joins me now by Zoom. Adam Carr, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Happy to be back with you, Joy.
So we're getting into fall, which to me feels crazy. It seems like in some ways there wasn't a summer, but there also was so much summer and time means nothing. So we're heading into September. And again, we have a list here that is a bit of in-person, a bit of digital stuff. And the first event is going to be at a place that I think a lot of people will be familiar with, Latino Arts.
Absolutely. Our first event, Café con Arte, 50 Years of Art and Cultural Diversity. It is, so they've been mounting for this last stretch a retrospective of the work of Reynaldo Hernandez, who is a phenomenal artist, muralist, who created the Mural of Peace, the Inner City Arts Council mural, many others around Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the world. So he has a long and rich career to dig into. So this exhibition is celebrating his life and his work. And this event, Managing Artistic Director of Latino Arts, Jacobo Lovo, who's a great storyteller. I've had a chance to learn a bunch from him in the galleries before. He's leading a gallery tour and discussion around the exhibit. It is in person, so it's right inside of the UCC front door at the Latino Arts Gallery. And, you know, they're taking all precautions. So check out the Facebook event. They are asking people to bring BYOC, bring your own coffee, bring masks. They will have fresh churros there for you if you do make the trip in. I think there's a $3 registration fee, but it is a unique, you know, all of us. And if you've been in Milwaukee, you know Ronaldo Hernandez's work in one way or another. This is a chance to dig a little bit deeper into his career and his phenomenal contributions to our city.
All righty. So the next one we're looking at is all in person. It's interesting because it's part of a conversation that we've all been having, I think, right now, but it does take a different kind of spin on it.
Absolutely. The next event, number two, is Home: Conversations on Black Lives Matter. And a little bit of background on this, the Linden Sculpture Garden, which is just up on the north side of just past beyond the city, is this incredible space with these monumental works of art. And they've taken, some leadership in saying we need to have important conversations, not just for the arts community, but for the broader community of Milwaukee. They've been doing this home series that's connected. It's about displacement and the arts. So they've been talking about new immigrants and refugees and done a series of events for that. Since the pandemic, they moved a lot of that digital. Kind of the trademark event for that is for World Refugee Day. But they've been engaging artists and people in Milwaukee and in really important conversations. This actually is a digital event. So it's going to be on Zoom. And the conversation on Black Lives Matter is going to be, they're going to be incredible folks who are based now in Milwaukee, who have backgrounds who are Hmong, Somali, Burmese, Rohingya, Chicana. So including some incredible people I know that are great contributors to the Milwaukee community. And they'll be talking about Black Lives Matter. And I think this will be, you know, there have been so many important conversations about Black Lives Matter locally and around the country. I haven't quite seen one like this before, where it is people who have backgrounds as new immigrants or as refugees. So I think that will be a very different set of perspectives on a conversation many of us might have been a part of during these last few months.
It is interesting to bring in voices of people who aren't from the United States, because when I think of Black Lives Matter, I do think of it as being a quintessentially, you know, U.S.-based conversation.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of the folks who are going to be taking part of this conversation are a little bit newer to Milwaukee, but some have spent most of their life here and have kind of a more hybridized identity as having feet in different parts of the world. So I think this is, I'm really looking forward to seeing what that conversation will look like.
So the next event is actually a week full of events, and they're both in person and online.
Absolutely. So Valley Week is something that happens every year, and it's really a celebration of the Menominee Valley. I just want to point out, because I'm kind of rooted in the history of Milwaukee a lot of times, that if you were to talk about doing a Valley Week 10, 20 years ago, people would say, why are you inviting people down to the Menominee Valley? We'd rather forget about that place. So the Menominee Valley has just seen this remarkable renaissance over the last 10, 15 years. And they're really just kind of inviting people to engage in the valley in a number of different ways. So there's a self-guided public art bike tour they've made. They're doing 3.7K, so a run that's also a beer run. It's a DIY run as well. There's a photography class. One of the things that's happened in the Menominee Valley, one of the things that kept people away, is that it had been sort of an industrial wasteland for a while. Now it's been remediated and there's all kinds of life happening in the valley again. There's a native gardening class. There's a virtual luncheon with John Gerda. There's all kinds of different events. There's a tea and botanicals cocktail class. They're even doing a blood drive. So Valley Week, the Menominee Valley, there's so many different ways to engage with it. And this week is really celebrating and inviting people into a number of those different ways. So Valley Week is September 12th through the 19th.
All righty. Now, this next kind of event, what I think is interesting about it is, in some ways, prior to September, this is something that really theoretically could have been happening all around Milwaukee. Tell us a bit about this.
So this next, this one, there's a couple layers to it. Niche Book Bar is a project of a woman named Satonia Weston Roy. And what she basically said is she's a lifelong reader and was having a hard time finding Black literature in all the different genres in which it exists. So she just kind of took it upon herself to create a mobile bookstore. So it's basically a bike that's outfitted with this really nifty trailer where she can display books and sell them to people. So that's, I think that's just like an amazing project in and of itself. She's been doing Tuesdays at Carver Park and Saturday mornings at Sherman Phoenix. And she decided September 20th through the 26th, she's going to take her shot at being in a storefront. So right off the corner of King Drive and North Avenue, there's a space called Queen Hustle, which welcomes pop-ups in. So from September 20th to the 26th, the Niche Book Bar will have a pop-up shop in that space. So I know that was a lot. There's so many interesting facets to that. I would check it out. Look up on Facebook, the Niche Book Bar pop-up shop. They're still determining their exact times for when they're going to be open, but she specializes, her thing is Black literature, and what's normally, and you know, she literally does just bike around and engage people with the store. She's going to have a home for a week right on King Drive.
For something that is, of course, admittedly niche, I mean, it's right in the name, right? having a bike that has books on it. It does seem like something that also has broad appeal.
Absolutely. I think there's so many fascinating details to that. And I actually have not yet met Satonia. So I think even just like getting a chance to talk to this person who's engaging in this incredible creative project, I think just in addition to it being a place where you could pick up books, I think there's just so many good reasons to go check that out in person.
So this next one, I'm thinking it's in person, although I don't exactly know, but from the name I would imagine it is Juntas at UWM.
Well, it actually isn't in person. So,
interesting.
So yeah, right. So Juntas is together, otherwise, Spanish for together. So UWM, I've had a chance to do some work with them, specifically their sociocultural programming department. And, you know, campus bubbles are a thing, and they do so many incredible things inside of that bubble. There's constantly great events happening on campus. They actually do great events out in the community. But sometimes if you're not a member of the UWM community, you don't know. I think so this moment of the pandemic, it creates a time for us to sort of pierce our bubbles a little bit and see what's happening in different spaces around our community. UWM is doing this event, Juntas. It's a brave space for Latinx women, femme, and non-binary identified students to share their cultural experiences with the community. And I think, you know, I was just talking to one of the organizers of it this morning, and they were mentioning there's going to be intergenerational conversations between elder activists and current activists. There's going to be conversations about building communal narratives, the kind of tools that are needed for support, success, and self-care. And I think all of that, in light of the pandemic and now the protests, it's a remarkably timely conversation as well. So this is an event that's happening digitally on September 25th from noon to 3 p.m. And I made sure to ask them, you know, are members of the community welcome? And they were very inviting of people to join. I think I might have missed saying the dates of the first two events. So just want to make sure I got that in, that the Cafe Con Arte is on September 12th, as is Home Conversations on Black Lives Matter. But, you know, if any of these events are interesting to you, there is more information out there online. Look them up. And Juntas happening at UWM, they really do have an amazing amount of stuff happening, you know, I'm doing air quotes, on campus. And now that campus is largely in the digital space, I think it's an interesting time for the public to see a little bit more from UWM.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Adam Carr, thank you so much for joining us and sharing these events. I can't believe I'm already saying this, but I look forward to talking to you in October.
Absolutely. The year is, you know, us sitting and talking in our makeshift studios, we kind of thought that might be a temporary thing, but we're getting used to talking to each other in our from your closet and from my living room.
Adam Carr is the deputy editor for community engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You can find more of our conversations with them about Milwaukee's Central City neighborhoods at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, then hear tips on how to protest safely during a pandemic. That's when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. The shooting of Jacob Blake by a Kenosha police officer sparked several nights of protests in the city. And these demonstrations are part of a larger movement around the country of people protesting against police brutality and racial injustice. While people are gathering and protesting, we're still in the middle of a global pandemic. So how can people demonstrate while maintaining their safety? Dr. Laura Cassidy is the research director for the Institute for Health and Equity at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She joined me earlier this summer to talk about the health concerns associated with these demonstrations and give her tips on how to stay safe while protesting. Dr. Cassidy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So my first question is a pretty simple one. When you're looking at these protests, what are your initial concerns regarding this pandemic?
My initial reactions are that the virus is still out there. And we've done a good job of containing it. We've all been so responsible and have protected each other and looked out for each other. But it's still there. And we know it passes from person to person. That's the only way it can be transmitted. So at first, I do feel a little bit of concern. And when we gather in crowds, it can pass faster. People are not always 6 feet apart. And a lot of people wore masks, but a lot of people didn't. And we need to make sure they wear them correctly. So my first concern was about the disease being transmitted from person to person.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I was at one of the marches. People were, most of them were wearing masks, but a lot of people are not 6 feet apart. People are, in some cases, shoulder to shoulder. When it comes to wearing masks, staying far apart, how good are these things at controlling the spread when you're already in a large group like this?
Right. So staying apart and wearing masks and washing our hands are some of the few ways we have to really control the virus. The good news is people were outside. So that's better than being inside. And they were wearing masks, which helps protect other people, but it doesn't protect you 100%. The other thing is when they're protesting, you're yelling, you're singing, you're chanting, and that causes the droplets to go farther. So that was a concern as well. And also people tend to put their masks on and off to talk or touch their face because of the mask, and that can actually promote spreading.
So what are some of the tips that you have for people who are walking in the protest, especially to make sure that they're staying as safe as possible while demonstrating?
Right. That's a really good question, because doing this safely is so important right now because it could affect our more vulnerable populations in the long run. So when you're walking, you know, put your arms out at arm length and try and make sure there's at least both arm lengths away from everybody. At least you're going in one direction, so you're not face to face. Wear your masks and bring hand sanitizer.
You know, I've seen a lot more cars trailing the protests than what I normally see. You know, they have signs, sometimes they have supplies for people. Is that a safer way to protest in a vehicle like that?
Well, it might be safer as far as transmitting disease, and if they're good drivers and they don't get in a car accident, of course, and wear seatbelts. I am an epidemiologist. However, if people are packing into cars and not wearing masks, then they're in a confined space where they could infect each other.
Okay. As far as supplies go, you know, we've seen a lot of people who are handing out water and things. I'm not sure if everybody is taking the kind of precaution of washing off things as they hand them to one another or start taking sips from things. How big is the risk of getting COVID-19 from touching something that somebody else who might be infected has touched?
Well, we do know now that the primary mode of transmission is person to person through droplets. However, you know, the virus can live on objects for a certain amount of time. So if somebody were infected with the virus and perhaps did not know they had it and were asymptomatic and sneezed or coughed or yelled and got droplets on the bottle, there is potential that if the next person took that bottle and touched their face, they could get infected.
But it's less of a concern than the person-to-person contact?
I think it's less likely, but it's still a concern.
Okay. So this is something we actually talked a bit about before the interview began. Police have been throwing tear gas canisters at people, and there's been a concern among some health professionals that this is increasing the chances of contracting coronavirus. Do you know why that would be?
You know, that's a really great question. And I don't think right now there's any data on it or research on it. But just if you think about it logically, if tear gas is being thrown, probably the first reaction is to wipe your eyes, perhaps to remove your mask or move it around. And it also creates chaos where people might bump into each other. They might touch each other more. They may be running. And also, I don't know the effect of the tear gas on the lungs and if it would make people more likely to get ill.
And certainly they'd be more likely to start coughing up.
Yes, I do believe you're right about that.
So we had been talking a lot about contact tracing, something that we've wanted to start more of to really understand how this disease is spreading. But right now we have a situation where there are thousands of people gathering in cities around the country. How could that impact contact tracing?
Yes, so this is a unique situation where we have a pandemic and we have crowds assembling. And if you look at a lot of the outbreaks across the country, they're due to crowding. New York City, people live so close together. Nursing homes, meatpacking plants. So this is an area where people are crowding and they may not know the people around them that they could be spreading the disease to or getting it from. So this is going to make it very challenging. And I think one of the keys is if you've been at one of these protests and you know of somebody who has tested positive for COVID, then please be proactive, go get tested, self-quarantine till you get the results. If you're feeling any symptoms, get tested and self-quarantine so that we don't continue to spread it. And do the best you can to report it and help with the contact tracing. But when you don't know, when you've been in a big crowd, you don't know the people you've been in contact with. I think, you know, if people are willing to share that they have been at the protest, that might help in some way.
Would you advise people who have been a part of these demonstrations to go get checked?
Yes, I think so. Generally, if you have symptoms or you've been in contact with somebody who has symptoms, you should get checked. But there is a lot of free testing out there. The thing to consider is the period between exposure and onset of symptoms. So if you were there yesterday and you go get a test today, it may not come up positive, but it might in a couple days. So, you know, there's a balancing act there where you may be carrying it and transmitting it and not knowing you have it, between that and being tested too soon.
Was there anything that I didn't ask you about that you thought I would?
I think, you know, something that has been worrying me that I've heard a lot from people is that because businesses are reopening and we're not at shelter in place anymore, that it's okay, we're safe, we can go out. And The reason that we are okay to go out and the virus, we've slowed the spread so much, is because of all of our individual behaviors in practicing good hygiene, distancing, you know, face coverings. And so I don't want that to stop. You know, we can continue through this if we do it together.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Cassidy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
And thank you so much. And, you know, I think this is a really important time in our lives, and I encourage people to be as safe as possible about this. And it's our responsibility, each one of us, to try to control this virus in these times.
Dr. Laura Cassidy is the research director for the Institute for Health and Equity at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the director of the PhD program in Public and Community Health and the Division of Epidemiology. We spoke with her in June. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Becca Schimmel join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Latoya Dennis, and Susan Benz from the WUWM News Team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.